Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether there will be a real change in our national security establishment that is so bloated and expensive that it's becoming a threat to America's economic health and security. A former National Security Council senior staffer for two presidents, Roger Morris, joins us to assess whether Chuck Hagel will be able to reform the Pentagon in the face of the shrill opposition from neoconservative shills for the military-industrial complex. Then we'll examine further Hagel's chances of being confirmed as Secretary of Defense, with many of his former Republican Senate colleagues leading the charge against him. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb joins us to discuss the forces arrayed against Hagel and the growing number of former senior military, diplomatic, and national security officials coming forward to support his nomination. Then finally, following the announcement today that President Hugo Chavez will not attend his own inauguration in Venezuela on Thursday, we will speak with Jennifer McCoy, who is the director of the Carter Center's Americas program, who has conducted election monitoring in Venezuela and is the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. We will discuss the growing constitutional dispute between the government and the opposition, whose leader said today, "There is no monarchy here, and we aren't in Cuba." Joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of the U.S.-Afghan relations and of America's policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And Roger, we spoke recently and you were skeptical that that President Obama would stand up for the Hagel nomination and stand his ground as instead of folding as he did with Susan Rice. He's obviously taking on a fight here.
Well, I think he is, and I'm always surprised, I must say, when this president stands his ground. We don't have a lot of precedent for that, as you know. We can only hope a second term will be different. But I do think this controversy is already overblown, and of course we're not into the hearings yet, but as Tallulah Bankhead once said about a Broadway play, there's less here, I think, than meets the eye. This is a definitely conservative former Republican senator. Chuck Hagel voted for the Patriot Act. He never really met a defense budget he didn't like in his 12 years in the Senate. He voted in October 22 for the Iraq War resolution. And you remember, Ian, well, that there were 23 senators, as well as a number of other political figures opposed to that resolution. So he was a firm and largely unconditional supporter of the Bush administration. I remember quite well, he voted for the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, the price of which we're paying now in so many different ways. He voted against McCain-Feingold and quite was an unconditional and unquestioning supporter of Israel during all of those years, which makes, of course, the questioning of his stance toward Israel somewhat ironic at this point. This is this was a Reagan Republican who got his start, after all, as a young Reagan organizer in Nebraska, went off to work for the Veterans Administration and then left in a policy difference, but went back with Reagan connections to make a private fortune, founding Vanguard Cellular, and eventually moving into the McCarthy Investment Banking outfit in Nebraska, and owning many of the of the voting machines that we still use today. They were a subsidiary of McCarthy, and you may remember there was controversy after his election in '96 to the Senate, and then again in 2002 about whether those voting machines might have influenced his winning margins. This is not a virginal, innocent, sort of late life liberal that we're looking at here, though the right wing, of course, tends to paint him that way. This is part of the problem of an atmosphere, a climate that is so sterile, so frozen, so perverse, really, in foreign policy terms that even Chuck Hagel can look like a rescuing progressive. The one thing I must say, which I think is encouraging, is that his change of heart after 2006, 2007, after it became rather painfully obvious that the Iraq War was a disaster, his change of heart there, his tendency to question later on again in his career the undying devotion to Israeli policy, to the Likud, rather than any kind of objective appraisal of American interests, that promises again in this very sterile and frozen atmosphere, perhaps some at least warm breath of change in the Obama administration. A Secretary of Defense, as you well know, can frame much of the agenda that comes to the president. He can frame part of the intelligence, although Hagel will have a rather serious rival in any effort to move off the dime here in John Brennan, the new nominee for the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
So, Roger Morris, yesterday I spoke with John Judas, who did a profile of Chuck Hagel for the New Republic back in 2007.
Yes.
And he pointed out that when he was he got his Purple Heart, so one of his Purple Hearts, for rescuing his own brother. They were both blown up in a armored personnel carrier that caught on fire, and the ammunition cooked off, and he managed to get his brother out. And his brother Tom, apparently, after the Vietnam War, went into a depression and felt that the war was immoral, and that his role in the war was immoral, and for the people that were killed and the lives that were wasted. And he became a sort of liberal law professor and a liberal Democrat, and always opposed the war. And whereas his older brother Chuck stood by it, and then later, when the tape was released of Lyndon Johnson, your the president that you once served, talking with Richard Russell about his doubts about the Vietnam War and about him sending the sergeant off to die, and he didn't even know what the hell the war was about, yet he felt that he was compelled to continue digging the hole deeper, that had a profound effect on Hagel. And then finally, during the Iraq War, he studied up on Vietnam and finally came to his brother's conclusion that the war was immoral because the political leaders had lied their way into these wars, both Iraq and Vietnam, and essentially the soldiers, like him and his brother, were just meat for the grinder for the political ambitions and cowardice of others.
You know, I think there is a class element in all of this, Ian. This is the first enlisted man, veteran of the Vietnam War, who will be Secretary of Defense, and I do think he'll be confirmed. I think Judas's piece was wonderful. It talked about the emotional impact of the war on Hagel. His conversion took a while, but I don't think we should doubt it. I think that there's every evidence that what he learned about the war in Iraq, and for that matter, the war in Afghanistan, was solid, and the evidence turned him against those enterprises. He really did challenge his own party and the prevailing orthodoxy of the surge and all the rest. He was a team player, but not a rote team player. And when he made, of course, his break with the orthodoxy of the Bush administration, that's when the wrath of the neocons and of the right wing came down on him. It was never really for any kind of major break on support of Israel or the defense budget, for that matter, or defense spending. It was all about the folly, the blunder, the tragedy of American involvement in Iraq.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. Now, just to digress a little bit because of your book on Between the Graves on on Afghanistan. You know, Karzai has just shown up in Washington, and I guess the White House, as a gambit, have floated the idea that maybe they won't leave anybody behind in Afghanistan, because obviously Karzai is there to soak as much money out of the Americans as he can, and that's basically what's been going on.
This is a time-honored technique, Ian. You may remember that the Soviets experienced this when they first began to talk seriously with the then leftist government in Kabul and in 1987-88, and finally left at the beginning of 89, and left behind, of course, not combat troops, but a very, very major aid investment, and I'm sure Karzai is counting on that at the very least. But this is a matter of separation anxiety for both sides. Certainly, Obama doesn't want to leave a disaster in his wake, and Karzai would like to preserve this. It's still shaky, but nonetheless, real power of the Kabul oligarchy, which he represents. So these are substantial dances in the minuet.
Well, I've talked to a specialist on Afghanistan and Pakistan who actually speaks all the local languages and worked there with the United Nations, and she describes the Karzai regime as a narco-kleptocracy, and that they basically have been parking all their money in the Gulf, and that a lot of that money, if not most of it, is U.S. taxpayer money.
Well, absolutely. I think when the final history, documented history of this war comes to be written, it will be perhaps, and this is really quite a distinction given Vietnam and all the rest, the most corrupt war in American history. There's no question that a lot of that money has been expatriated and it awaits the last flights out of Kabul, which we will inevitably see. How the United States handles that, how it justifies it, what regime we'll have in Washington, of course, God only knows. But that's only a matter of time after the Americans exit. What regime takes power is by no means clear, because it's not going to be this simplistic Taliban that is the demon of the American media and the rather all too simple image of the American public.
So there's a flare-up in Kashmir at the moment. There have been some cross-border incursions, and a Pakistani soldier was killed a few days ago, and then two Indian soldiers were killed yesterday. And I recall that when the special envoy to the White House, that Obama appointed Richard Holbrooke as his special envoy, the first thing that Holbrooke wanted to do was to take on the Kashmir portfolio, on the basis that if you can solve the Kashmir problem, which is certainly easy to solve, or should be easy to solve, then that takes away a lot of the tension between India and Pakistan and takes away a lot of the justification for the Pakistani military to dominate their politics. He apparently got nowhere, Holbrooke, because the Indian lobby, which has modeled itself on the Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C., basically scuttled the deal. Is there any reason to be concerned about this latest flare-up in Kashmir? And is there any way that this ridiculous battle between people that are literally at 20,000 feet, they can barely breathe the air and they're shooting at each other?
Well, this is, of course, one of the long-standing running sores in American foreign policy. That issue should have been solved a long time ago, and we had a great deal more leverage with both governments. It's not just the Indian lobby, although that's a very, very substantial force, and you're quite right. It has modeled itself on the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, which has been, after all, a precedent and a model for a number of these groups. But it's also the American military. Long-standing relationship with Pakistan. I mean, the two sides here are thoroughly corrupted by the vested interests. Holbrooke, I think, had the right idea, but was unable and not even be able to start, really, to implement that under the Obama administration. And the White House had surrendered very early on to the Pentagon and to the military in Afghanistan. Holbrooke was never able to make up that distance. And I find it ironic now that we have all this praise, all this public praise for Hillary Rodham Clinton as such a successful Secretary of State. My goodness, I think her chief distinction is would be her frequent flyer miles. She failed utterly to grasp the AFPAC problem, she and Holbrook together. And by the time anyone got around to really seriously analyzing that, the issue was moot. I think Hagel will face, ironically, now as Secretary of Defense, what he only glimpsed as a sergeant, as a squad leader in Vietnam, and that's the agony of an orderly withdrawal from a war which is a rather ignominious defeat. He's not one of the many fathers or mothers of that defeat, but he certainly will have to preside over the management of it.
And Roger Morris, again, served on the National Security Councils under both President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. The premise, though, of my introduction to the program today and to you is there a possibility of a real change in our national security establishment that is so bloated and expensive that it's becoming a threat to America's economic health and security? Hagel himself has said the defense budget is bloated. So is there any reason to believe that this absolutely ridiculous situation where the U.S. outspends almost all of the world combined and all of its enemies, potential, real, imagined, whatever, tenfold or a hundredfold or whatever? I mean, we're literally fighting a bunch of irregulars. We're not fighting the Soviet Union that could, within 20 minutes, wipe out the entire United States.
Well, I think there's hope, Ian, if this is the condition that underlies all of this, if indeed there is a second administration Obama, unlike the first administration's president. These are going to be decisions that Obama will make, I think in part, of course, for political expedience, but certainly in large measure also for his own legacy. The defense budget is the popular and natural target. This has got to be one of the first priorities. If Medicare is the last priority for the cuts, the defense budget has got to be the first. And one can only hope that Hagel will bring that tough squad leader sergeant's view that there is an enormous amount of fat and waste and corruption. The military-industrial complex relationship with the Pentagon, of course, is one of the great old and enduring scandals in Washington. To get hold of that would be a major historic act by Hagel. But he faces a much more formidable opposition than any previous defense secretary has. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. This drone lobby is enormous. It's not just, this is the legacy of 9/11, it's not just the Pentagon or the military-industrial world. It is this whole new intelligence empire, what I would call the irregulars, led by the CIA and their paramilitary presence, and all of the contractors who now crowd Northern Virginia and the Maryland suburbs of Washington in proportions and with influence and magnitude and wealth and power in the Congress never before seen in Washington. This is a new world. It's the post 9/11 world. So to talk merely about cutting the defense budget or recalibrating American foreign policy and getting control of this national security monster is by no means simply a matter of it was never simple, but it was enormously difficult. But simply a matter of the Pentagon itself. It is three or four or five times larger and more formidable than anything any of us who were in government in the 60s or 70s ever faced, or even for that matter, dreamt of.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, Roger Morris, because in that secret tape that Bob Woodward revealed of Fox News soliciting Petraeus to become president of the United States, with Murdoch financing the campaign and Roger Ailes running the campaign, what Petraeus said there was that he didn't want to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, not that he would ever be offered that, but he said that he really thought that the job as head of the CIA would be the best job to have, because that's where all the action's going to be. That's where the future of warfare will be. So Petraeus saw what you're talking about.
I think he did, and you know, it's ironic, Ian, we've got a discussion now about Brennan, the new director of the CIA, or the nominee, making a shift from his policy-making role. I heard this today in a broadcast. Shifting from his policy-making role in the White House as the counterterrorism resident expert to director of the CIA, where he will only be processing information and not making policy. That, of course, is absurd. This is a policy-making organization, more powerful than it ever has been before, and it's always been very powerful indeed. This is a huge, it's quite apt to call it, as you did, the national security establishment, because it's much more than just the uniform military, much more than just the weapons makers and the purveyors and traders and all the rest. It is now a vast political and bureaucratic presence in Washington, and their call for, of course, on Capitol Hill and in the White House.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, as bad as what you're talking about, the new drone lobby and all of the contractors up there at Tyson's Corner, the other part of it, which is actually the legacy of Bill Perry and these Democratic defense intellectual, is this massive fraud known as stealth. And this F-35, which is the largest military contract in the history of mankind, is producing a totally useless airplane, as is the F-22, a useless airplane. And the Russians sell a radar for $10 million that can pick up these planes.
Yeah.
And I talked to the designer of the A-10 and the F-16 the other day, and he's tearing his hair out, Pierre Spray, you know, that the plane, this F-35, is replacing the F-16 that he designed, and the F-16 outperforms this aircraft in every category.
And you're absolutely right. This is a bipartisan disaster and has been for a long time. And people talked about alternatives to Hagel to avoid the controversy. Someone like Michelle Coyne, who's a longtime advocate of these programs. And I mean, this is Michelle Flournoy. I said Coyne.
Yeah, the queen of Coyne, she's called. Yeah.
She is Ms. Coyne in the Pentagon, the counterinsurgency strategy. The Democrats have been as ardent and, in their own way, as corrupt in these matters as the Republicans. It's not an accident that we have never had a serious debate about national security strategy, let alone significant or meaningful reform of the Pentagon or of the intelligence establishment.
Well, just in closing, Roger Morris, is there any chance that the American public will demand more from the Pentagon? I mean, here we are wasting trillions of dollars on useless airplanes to fight the Cold War, and they don't even work. I mean, it's bad enough to waste money, but at least you ought to be able to produce something at the end of the day that you can use. And it's so obscene that it's laughable.
I despair of that, Ian, simply because I don't think anyone of any stature left in the Democratic Party is sufficiently versed in this or politically courageous enough to take it on. Someone like Barney Frank, who spent a long time looking at these issues and knew something about the Pentagon budget, can leave the Congress and can frame a critique. But you don't have anyone, and at least of all the heir or heiress apparent for the presidency in 2016, who's in a position to even understand how this world works and its magnitude, the difficulty, and the details. The devil here is always in the details. And this is perhaps the single most urgent and decisive problem facing a new administration. And of course, it will get, I think, only short shrift.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is Between the Graves, which is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former Assistant Secretary of Defense about Hagel's chances of being confirmed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
And what do you think of the chances of Chuck Hagel's nomination being derailed? There are certainly some fairly vocal and well-organized forces arrayed against him, and there may be some wavering Democrats, senators. So the president's been accused of not sticking his neck out and taking chances and folding preemptively, if you will, with Susan Rice. Let's start with this question. Does his choice of Chuck Hagel indicate that he's going to go to the mat for him?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, he has to. And I think to the extent we're not quite sure whether he really wanted Susan over Senator Kerry, but the fact of the matter is there was that ambivalence there. So I think, you know, basically he had to nominate, Chuck when, you know, all this opposition came up, or people would have think, gee, we can roll this guy on lots of things.
So what about the wavering Democrats, in particular Cardin in Maryland and Chuck Schumer in New York?
Well, I think basically after the hearing is over, a lot of the claims that people have made, you know, I mean, this ridiculous thing about anti-Semitism, for example, I mean, they'll really be debunked. I mean, a lot of them already have, and I think once that's clear, the senators who have doubts can say, well, you know, they made this claim, but I had the hearing, I looked into it, there's no basis for it. So therefore, I'm going to support him. And obviously, the Democrats don't want to undermine Obama either, because, you know, they need a stronger hand when they do, you know, deal with all of these, financial issues.
Well, apparently, the AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, they have decided to stay neutral in the Hagel nomination.
Well, I think that that's important, because there's been a lot of concerns expressed by a lot of, Jewish Americans about some of these, claims. I mean, like Richard Cohen, the columnist in the Post, Tom Friedman, and basically said that these claims are, his words, you know, disgusting and disgraceful.
So you've served as Assistant Secretary of Defense, and the challenges for any Secretary of Defense in terms of reforming the Pentagon, in particular, taking on the Pentagon budget. Is this the right guy for the job? Because a lot of the Joint Chiefs and other senior officers have talked about downsizing the Pentagon as a kind of inevitability. That's not what you hear on Capitol Hill, but it's what you hear amongst the top uniformed officers.
Well, I think you can't find a person with better qualifications than Senator Hagel to do that, because if you're going to, you know, downsize the military, you'll get, you know, pushback from some people in the military, some people on the Hill, and say, well, you don't know what it's like. You can say, yes, I do. You know, I've been a war veteran. You know, I've been wounded. I've got Purple Heart. He also understands the legislative process, which, you know, some people who come in from the outside, you know, do not. I mean, he knows how to manage. He's been very successful in the private sector. And as I look at it, I've never seen a person who has all of the qualifications that he has. Some people, like Dick Cheney and Melvin Laird, you know, had a legislative background. They didn't have, the extensive, management, background. You have a lot of other people who've had management background but are not war heroes. I mean, he's the only person ever nominated has two Purple Hearts. Only one, Elliot Richardson, had one. But other than that, you know, nobody did. So I think he has, he comes into this with a very strong hand.
Well, he's apparently popular with the rank and file, with the boys, if you will. But, you know, so much of the Pentagon budget is driven by the toys, and the boys are often sacrificed for the toys. And you've got these big programs like the F-35, which is essentially, I think it's the biggest military contract in the history of mankind, and it takes up about 40% of the entire procurement budget. So there's an awful lot of low-hanging fruit in the toys department. So he may be popular with the boys, but how's he going to cut the toys?
Well, again, I think when, he understands how the legislative process works, because you're obviously going to have to get the Congress to go along with whatever cuts that you make. And again, he understands the role of the military in the world. I mean, that's the one way to get it. Obviously, when it's poorly managed, that's one thing. But when you can say, well, look, here's the threats, how does this line up, with what the threats are? Because, again, we've had executives come in like, Charlie Wilson from General Motors, but they didn't know the foreign policy. I mean, he knows that as well, so he can marry the two together.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in the Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. So is there a strategy out there that he can be identified with, one that really does deal with the 21st century and is not a holdover from the Cold War, where we're still, essentially the F-35 is an example of a Cold War toy designed to fight an enemy in the air that doesn't exist?
Well, I think he can, because when he comes in, he's going to, come up. For example, one of the issues what he's been very strong on is cutting nuclear weapons. And you're at an inflection point now where you're going to have to modernize all three legs of the triad. We know President Obama from his Prague speech wants to cut that. So this would be an area that he could begin right now. It would be an awful lot of savings. And again, because, having 5,000 nuclear weapons really is a carryover from the Cold War. I think the fact that we've said, we're not going to do any more land wars, do nation building, he can then, trim the size of the ground forces back. So, no, I think, he has a strategy. He's spoken out on it. I mean, he's been after he left government, he's been actively involved as, the head of the Atlantic Council, which, deals with a lot of these issues.
So the fact that the Emergency Committee for Israel is going to be buying TV ads going against Chuck Hagel, Ralph Reed, who runs the Faith and Freedom Coalition, is also gearing up a campaign against Hagel, as is the Concerned Women of America. So you have these groups, these so-called independent groups that are out there, and they're going to be starting to buy airtime. How much can they muddy the waters, and when does this guy get to defend himself?
Well, obviously, whenever they schedule the hearings, and now that he's been nominated, he can speak out. He's already spoken out. But the interesting thing, and I've never seen this before, you got a lot of groups organizing and buying ads to support him, headed by former secretaries of defense, national security advisors, former ambassadors. It's an amazing thing. I've never seen, when other nominees have gotten in trouble, this, outpouring of very distinguished members of the foreign policy establishment.
So what do you think's going on there? Do you think that this could be an overreach for the Bill Kristols of the world in terms of their preemptively trying to slime this guy?
Oh, very definitely, because, you know, in addition to, you know, kind of what Tom Friedman calls this disgraceful, you know, type of, you know, personal attacks, you know, they said, well, you know, you said the war in Iraq was all about oil. Well, yeah, and a lot of other people did, including, you know, Alan Greenspan and General Abizaid. And you see, that's what they're coming back. I mean, they're not letting these things hang out there. And I think, you know, when you have people like Frank Carlucci was National Security Advisor and Secretary of Defense under, you know, a Republican president, you know, General, you know, Brent Scowcroft, you know, National Security Advisor for two presidents. When they come out, I think, you know, the members on the Hill are going to say, wait a second, do we believe this group or that group, Ralph Reed or Brent Scowcroft?
Right. And you think that Scowcroft would testify? I mean,
Yeah, he's already written letters. Right. Okay. And you know, so I mean, they're already on the record, you know, with these things. You've had all national security advisors for Obama and Carter and Reagan, you know, coming out, for him. So, no, I think so. You had Bush's ambassador to Israel speaking out for him.
Well, but on the people that will be asking the hostile questions, though, this is what's a little surreal about this, Larry Korb, is the people that are going to be asking the hostile questions, one of them is his old friend and mentor, John McCain. I mean, he's already out of the gate suggesting that Hagel's a mistake. And Lindsey Graham tried to suggest that Obama shouldn't have made the pick in the first place and said it's an in-your-face pick, as though in choosing Hagel, President Obama spoiling for a fight.
Well, obviously, you know, they've made these statements, and he may have, you know, a handful of people vote against him. You know, when Bob Gates went up to be head director of the CIA, not the Secretary of Defense, he had 33 people vote against him because of questions about his role in, you know, the so-called Iran-Contra, you know, scandal. So it's not unusual, you know, to have, you know, some people vote against you. But the fact of the matter is he's going to be confirmed. And McCain, you know, may vote against him in the committee, but his nomination will, you know, get out of the committee, you know, favorably, and it will go to the floor. Will it be a tough thing? Sure, it will. But see, what really bothers Republicans, particularly like Graham, this exposes the differences in the Republican Party between what you might call some people call the neocons and the traditional Republicans, like the, you know, the Brent Scowcrofts, for example.
So you think that may come back to bite them?
Oh, very, very definitely. I got to tell you, I mean, I think that if they, you know, continue, I mean, it's going to do to the Republicans in foreign policy what, you know, the immigration issue, you know, has done to them on domestic policy. I mean, if they take this thing too long and, you know, people, you know, pay attention to it, they're going to say, you know, that what happened to the Republican, to the Republican Party. And, you know, in addition to everything else we haven't even mentioned, it's a decorated war hero, served two terms in the Senate because he bucked the party line on Iraq. You know, they're going to get, you know, the American people have turned against these wars.
So what about then the Israel card, which the Bill Kristols are playing? Is that going to backfire already?
I think so. I mean, you see, as I say, you've seen Jewish columnists like Roger Cohn in the New York, you know, Times today, Richard Cohen in the Washington Post, Tom Friedman, you know, all saying, wait a second here. You know, this is just because you don't support the policies of a particular, you know, government, you know, in Israel doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic.
Well, specifically, it was the fact that in an interview for a book with Aaron David Miller, Chuck Hagel said that the Jewish lobby intimidates a lot of people up here on the Hill, and I'm the senator from, I'm a U.S. senator, not an Israeli senator.
Right, yeah. he did say that.
But that's not, you know, I just find it hard to believe that that's a terribly controversial thing. You're in that town. How controversial is it?
It's not controversial at all, and that's why I say people are trying to make it, you know, controversial. I mean, people, you know, they're desperate when they're digging up things. One of the interesting things yesterday, Elliot Abrams talked about the fact when he was running the USO, Basically, you know, he wanted the people in Haifa to, you know, help, you know, support it because the USO was bankrupt. And, you know, I mean, that type of thing shows that they're really, you know, reaching for anything they can.
Well, curiously enough, a Republican senator in Israel, speaking in Israel just yesterday, called for an end to aid to Israel, saying that Israel, you know, doesn't need to be the number one recipient of U.S. aid. They're doing very well on their own. And there was nothing controversial about. I mean, it was Rand Paul who seems to be able to speak his mind without getting dumped on like Chuck Hagel. It's pretty surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's why I say I think this isn't going to fall apart when all is said and done.
Just in closing then, Lawrence Korb, let's turn to the possibility that there could be some serious changes at the Pentagon and that there could be some real reforms short of you know, if they assuming they avoid this sequester, which they've got a 2 month reprieve because of this fiscal cliff deal. On that, how is he going to do this? I mean, assuming that this is what he wants, and he's hinted, Hagel, in a speech he made when he talked about Pakistan, he's hinted about the idea that the last thing the U.S. needs is boots on the ground, particularly in parts of the world where they're not welcome, and then they have to find other ways to project military power. And, you know, there's obviously going to be some more nuances, shall we say, in a new policy, if indeed one is able to get off the ground.
Well, I think that's why he comes to it with, as I say, with the legislative skills of successful secretaries like Melvin Laird and Dick Cheney, the management skills of, you know, McNamara, and the war record that nobody else has. So if anybody can do it, I think, you know, he will be able to do it. And as a result of whenever we solve this so-called fiscal cliff and budget thing, there's going to be more cuts of the Pentagon. And so I think he will have to reform that, and he will have the credibility to do that.
Well, just in closing, what about the other two candidates that were Ashton Carter and Michelle Flournoy? Is there a role for them in the Pentagon?
Well, I mean, Ash Carter is the deputy. I don't know if he'll, you know, stay. People have talked about him maybe be moving over to the you know, to the Energy Department. Michelle Flournoy, you know, she left about a year ago saying she wanted to spend more time with the children. So I'm not quite sure, you know, where, you know, whether she wants a job or does or, you know, whatever. But, you know, they're certainly qualified candidates, but not they're not in Hagel's league when you come to the background.
So there's a team to be put together. We just don't know who that team is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I, you know, I don't know if Michelle's ready to go back in as policy director, or, you know, whether she wants to move up to be dead. I just don't know. But obviously, he can't start putting together a team until he gets confirmed, because then people will say, you know, you're jumping the gun, or you're not being quote unquote humble enough, or however they do it.
Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, good to be with you. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Hugo Chavez missing his own inauguration and the political ramifications in Venezuela.
The newborn in the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer McCoy, who's the director of the Carter Center's Americas Program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. Previously, she directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004 and has directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru. She spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow and has also edited and contributed to several books on the topic of Venezuelan democracy, most recently, The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
And Vice President Nicolas Maduro today broke the news that President Chavez would not be attending his own inauguration on Thursday. He's broke the news in a letter to the president of the National Assembly, Diosdado Sabello. And what's interesting about this situation is that, in a way, the demise of Hugo Chavez is pitting Sabello, who is an old friend, against his anointed successor, Vice President Nicolas Maduro, because under the Constitution, Sabello would be the interim president until things were decided. And yet, at the same time, Chavez has picked Nicolas Maduro as the man to as his chosen successor. So, do you see, even with the opposition being upset with the situation and feeling that the Constitution is being violated, within the Chavistas themselves, it looks like we're heading to a showdown.
Well, that is certainly one thesis. I'm not sure that that's the case, though, and it is confusing. For several reasons. One is because, for people outside to understand, Venezuela's vice president is not elected. It's an appointed position. And that's why the opposition argue that when this current term ends and President Chavez did appoint Nicolas Maduro to be his vice president, that the vice president's term would also end tomorrow. The other issue is that the Constitution itself doesn't specify all of the scenarios, including one of a re-elected president being sick on his inauguration. And so it specifies what happens if there's a temporary absence of the president because he's sick, or a permanent absence of a president if he becomes so incapacitated he can't govern anymore. But now we're talking about a re-elected president unable to appear for his inauguration. And that is part of the issue of what's going on. I'm not convinced it's a competition between these two parts of the Chavista movement, these two men who sort of lead different factions. So that could be one part of it. I think it might be more. Another thesis is that it's simply there's so much public support for the president as president that he's the elected president and public opinion is strongly behind him, and that people don't want to see him removed, even in a temporary way, from his post if he still has the chance to recover. Of course, the big question is we don't know exactly what the prognosis is because they haven't told us. And so that's a great uncertainty for Venezuela.
Well, isn't that something that bothers a lot of Venezuelans I've spoken with? They sort of resent the idea that Cuba plays such a prominent role. Chavez is the president of Venezuela, after all. There's been so much secrecy from day one about his illness. And some sources that I've spoken to are suggesting that he simply is on his deathbed, and that's why he can't come to the inauguration. So, what's your sense then of let's go with that scenario then? If he simply cannot show up and will not show up,
Hugo Chavez has been such a larger-than-life figure in Venezuela for 14 years and has personalized not only the presidency but the nation in his own person and concentrated power also in his own hands, so that he's been heavily involved in decision making at all different levels. So it's another explanation may be that it's difficult for his aides and members of his government to take the decision to decide that he's unable to govern without having a very clear answer from that physically or from his own lips that he wants to resign. So possibly, you know, that may be what's going on. If he's unable to communicate at the moment, but may be able to in the future, that kind of thing. Again, this is just speculation because we don't really know. As you said, he's getting treatment in Cuba, and there's not a lot of information coming out other than the official pronouncements that he's in a delicate condition, but, you know, can still recover. So tomorrow there will be, you know, not an inauguration, but apparently some rallies of support for the president. And so far it looks like the government will simply continue with President Chavez as president in absentia and the current vice president as vice president and the current head of the National Assembly in that position. That, of course, is what the opposition is contesting. They've asked the Supreme Court to rule on whether that can continue in this way or whether that's an official vacuum of power. Today, the Supreme Court answered one of the petitions to it, saying that they will not order the president of the National Assembly to take over in an absence of President Chavez. There are two other petitions waiting for an answer, so we may get another answer tomorrow or in the future from the Supreme Court. But thus far, the Supreme Court is not acting to challenge the government's position that President Chavez is still president and continues through this re-election and will be inaugurated at the point that he's able to.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer McCaw, who's the director of the Carter Center's Americas Program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. She's been an election monitor in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004 and is the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. It's a little confusing, obviously, it must be more so in Venezuela itself. But the Constitution is pretty clear, is it not, that Vice President Nicolas Maduro will have to run if Chavez is unable to serve his term for which he's just been, a six-year term for which he's just been elected.
That's exactly right. And that's the issue with the vice president not being an elected position. Then the Constitution says that if the president is unable to continue in office because he dies or is incapacitated, there should be elections within 30 days and elect a new president that would fulfill that term. So that would be the rest of the six-year term. President Chavez, before he went to Cuba in December for this most recent surgery and illness, actually endorsed Nicolas Maduro to be his successor and asked the people to vote for him should they need to call new elections. That was the first time he had done that and indicated that he might not be able to continue. And so some people view that as his way of preparing Venezuelans for the possibility that he couldn't come back. But Nicolas Maduro certainly has, with that endorsement, then that gives him, you know, that advantage in any election that might be coming for the supporters of Chavez, who would say we want to follow, you know, that endorsement. It gives him a big boost in any future election.
But if Chavez were to die, Cabello would hold the post of interim president, right? Before the new elections, which will be called within 30 days.
Well, this is where it does get confusing because of the timing of this. If the Supreme Court upholds the government's current position, Nicolas Maduro, the vice president, would continue in office. And nothing would happen unless President Chavez were to die. If that were to happen, then yes. The president of the National Assembly, Cabello, would take over, and there would be elections, or the Supreme Court could say if they were continuing the idea that this period was simply continuing, then the vice president would take over. This is really the difficult to explain the situation, because in a normal time, if the inauguration had already happened and President Chavez were inaugurated and were able to come and then was incapacitated, his vice president would be the one to take over in the interim period until elections.
So
he's president.
So I'm just thinking forward then. Could you have an election then that would have Cabello running against Maduro and also Enrique Capriles, the fellow who lost the last election, who's the leader of the opposition?
Yes, you could have as many candidates as wanted to run. That's entirely possible, that there would be multiple opposition candidates and multiple candidates from the governing party. The reason why I think that's unlikely is that, and President Chavez certainly took the effort to make that unlikely for his own party by endorsing one candidate. So unless there was a break from that and sort of an open power struggle, I wouldn't expect there to be more than one candidate for the governing party. The opposition would have to decide, would they run a united candidate, or would there be multiple people who, you know, wanted to try their candidacy? And that's hard. That, I think, will depend on the timing. If we're talking about a very snap election within 30 days, then very soon it'll be difficult for the opposition to probably choose another unity candidate beyond the one that they chose last year, who was Capriles, who you mentioned. If there's more time to prepare, if elections look like they'll be delayed sometime, then perhaps there would be time to either choose another opposition candidate or for multiple people to prepare their own campaign.
Well, just in closing, though, it would seem that if Chavez is to die soon, as some expect, the opposition wouldn't have a prayer. I mean, he got pretty badly trounced in October, Capriles, I imagine the sympathy vote will be huge.
I think the sympathy vote would be huge. And then we also had the elections in December for governor when the governing party won 20 out of 23 state governors. So that was not a good showing for the opposition. And so if this, you know, happens soon and President Chavez, you know, if he were to die soon and elections called soon, I think there would be a huge sympathy vote. If he recovers, that is not able to come back to govern for very long, or if there's some scenario where it gets stretched out longer and there's an interim government, that scenario actually is declaring a temporary absence, which could go up to 6 months. Then the situation might be different for the opposition.
Well, Jennifer McCoy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's the director of the Carter Center's America's Program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. Previously, she directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004 and has directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru. And she is the author of, most recently, The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.